Okay, so today will be fun. Globalism in theory and practice is what I originally called it. Some things that are most recent I didn't get into, and I think it's just as well because I probably already talked about those things in various other weeks, in various other issues of economics, environmentalism, foreign policy, things like that. Really, today we're just going to take a little historical reconnaissance, but we're going to start, in a sense, in sociology, and let's just do some worldview thinking. I have some isms over here on the left, and you know, like anything else, this is not a class about who to vote for or anything like that. This is a class about how to think about these things worldview-wise, and then you can apply that and make inferences. So we're going to really start in worldview. But obviously, today we are going to touch on things that, for lack of a better phrase, are often called conspiracy theory. In fact, 99% of the time, they're called conspiracy theory. But I guess it all depends on how you look at it. So let's start controversially, in a sense. One of the more infamous State of the Union addresses in the 20th century, President George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush I, addressed Congress. This is before the Gulf War, so the year before, 1990. And a nationally televised audience, and I believe this is it was September 11th, a fact that conspiracy enthusiasts never tire of reminding us. It was on September 11th, not 1991, 10 years before. No, it was on 1990, September 11th, and Bush said this to Congress. "Today, a new world is struggling to be born. A world quite different than the one we've known. A world in which the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a chance at this new world order, an order in which the credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the United Nations founders." Now, on March 6th of the following year, following the Gulf War, at its conclusion, he said, "Until now, the world we've known has been a world divided, a world of barbed wire and concrete block, conflict and cold war. Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is a very real prospect of a new world order. In the words of Winston Churchill, a world order in which the principles of justice and fair play protect the weak against the strong, a world where the United Nations, freed from Cold War stalemate, is poised to fulfill the historic vision of its founders. A world in which freedom and respect for human rights find a home among all nations." Now, those sound like a lot of high-minded and good ends. And whoever was around back then or paying attention, you might remember that Bush and pretty much every member of his cabinet, especially President Bush, would use that phrase, New World Order, pretty much every second he got a chance to, for the last year or two of his administration. And then it really went quiet a little bit, but think tank policy nerds and people like that would continue to use the phrase and resurrect it from time to time. But the phrase was used by H.G. Wells in the 1930s in his futurist writings. Of course, it was also frequently used by Adolf Hitler. But Wells's fiction notwithstanding, he actually wrote another book. We meant to be serious. It was called The New World Order, where he said this: "In the great struggle to evoke a westernized world socialism, contemporary governments may vanish. Countless people will hate the New World Order and will die protesting against it." So this is something that Western intellectuals, just to give you a little brief survey, have believed. It's kind of their eschatology. It's their kingdom of God. In that sense, if you put it that way, really, the liberal theology in the 19th century was no different, except that they had no power. They were just a bunch of religionists and a dying worldview in Western civilization. But they believed that the kingdom of God was something to be enacted by politics, and it was something that, by definition, was global in scope. And so, this is really a worldview issue, first, before it's anything else. And one of the worldview issues we have not covered yet is just our philosophy of history. In the first couple of weeks, we looked at politics in general and how theology determines politics. But really, we should be looking at our philosophy of history too. And so I have here on the board these isms here. And in a Christian view, you would have divine providence standing over these two other things, reason and nature. But if you don't come from a Christian worldview, You're left with these extremes. So there's two extremes to our interpretation of present history. In other words, how we understand where we are, how we got here, in the big picture of history. And you understand that even though history would be defined as the written record of mankind, another definition of it, but understanding of it is the big things that have happened. By definition, you don't remember the things that are insignificant. They don't show up in history books. So naturally, it's going to be a bunch of people either using power for good or, mostly, in a world of sin, conspiring to use power to oppress people, to use strength to fulfill their own gratification and stuff like that. Well, I've come up with these two words. Actually, I didn't come up with them, but I don't hear them used a lot, so I'm just going to use them to describe these two different extremes of how to interpret history. Accidentalism and conspiracism. And you'll see right away how they oppose each other. An accidentalist, I'm defining, as someone who sees the flow of history as either naturally ordered, completely, in other words, only natural cause and effect, not rationally, intelligently designed at any level. The big picture is naturally ordered, or chaotically, a chaotic collection of accidents, marginalizing the human element to the realm of chance or fate. While a conspiracist is just going to have the exact opposite problem. He's just someone who sees the whole world through the lens of a finite conspiracy or a set of finite conspiracies. So consider the standard dictionary definition of these two words. First of all, an accident. An accident, according to the brass at Merriam-Webster, is, quote, an unfortunate event resulting from carelessness, unawareness, ignorance, or a combination of causes. In other words, purely natural causes. An unexpected happening causing loss or injury, which is not due to any fault or misconduct on the part of the person injured, but for which legal relief may be sought. So notice the emphasis in that definition on ignorance of causality. And because we're ignorant of the causes, because the causes, in a sense, are bigger than us, therefore there's limitations on our moral ability to praise or to blame or to counteract those forces. Now, a conspiracy, by contrast, is not simply to act together toward a rational end. Not just people getting together, but the dictionary would define it as, quote, an evil, unlawful, treacherous, or surreptitious plan formulated in secret by two or more persons. A plot. A combination of persons for a secret, unlawful, or evil purpose, and the third part of that definition, is an agreement by two or more persons to commit a crime, fraud, or other wrongful act. Well, I don't want to say the vast majority of crimes, but a whole lot of crimes, certainly organized crimes, are all conspiracies by that definition. Now, in a sense, there'd be no difference between the study of natural science and the study of history unless we understood that history is almost nothing but the study of conspiracies. If we take the dictionary at its word, then history is nothing other than the mixture of these two forces. Those two, well, I have there nature and reason. I put here in my notes nature and contrivance. In other words, intelligent design, except in this case, inside the circle of nature, finite designers. We're not talking about divine providence at this point. So, history is almost nothing other than the mixture of these two forces down here. Namely, human beings acting according to individual and collective ends, and then secondly, the natural consequences of those ends in society, which of course then shape and, you know, shape the flow of future rational agents. It's when we pit nature against contrivance, or reason and conspiring against nature, that we wind up at the irrational extremes of accidentalism and conspiracism. Now, putting both of those in the context of divine providence, theologically, and only a Christian can do that, immediately solves the problem of falling off to one of these two extremes. Once we get going on this stuff today, you'll be tempted to forget about this and see that as this big thing. But if you're a Christian, you can put that on a board and then erase it. And not necessarily forget about it, but put it in its place. Because compared to God, it's very, very small. Okay? So, the bottom line is that if these things are not studied with objective political science, within objective political science, They are absolutely unintelligible. And here's the important point. They're unintelligible to everyone. The thing being discussed, no matter which conspiracy it is, no matter how much evidence someone has for one, or one, you know, the whole thing being one, the thing being discussed will be torn from its actual context and placed within the irrational lens of conspiracism, a worldview on its own. So no one will understand what's being talked about. Those who are accidentalist in their orientation will hear nothing but an intellectual stench in the ears. And here's the kicker. Even those who are conspiracists will have learned nothing new, but a few more cynical talking points to what they already believed. No real cultural advance will have occurred. No real moral responsible action will be marshaled. No truth will have transformed anyone or changed anything for the better. So the problem I have with conspiracy theories as they go on the market is not that an awful lot of it is not true. It's that the person's coming from a very truncated worldview and winds up not communicating anything intelligible to anybody. So it doesn't accomplish anything. It's much ado about nothing. So let's start with a sociological phenomenon. So move from major worldview pieces to treating this sociologically, because that's going to be one of the most powerful arguments to globalize, is this thing that we call globalization. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at globalism as a sociological phenomenon. We'll look at it historically, economically, politically, and philosophically. I have two big ideas, one for this and then one for once we get into that timeline. They're very wordy, but I don't know how else to say them. So I'll just repeat them and explain to you why I said it this way. The big idea for this, the sociological beginning, is that globalization as a phenomenon, in other words, as an event in history, globalization as a phenomenon has preceded globalism as a philosophy of the mind. So maybe look at it like this. Down nature versus reason. Globalism down here is a thing that's happening that you can look at and observe in history. Today in economics, in the internet. The internet, just an example of a globalizing phenomenon, precedes globalism as a philosophy of mind. But here's the kicker. Yet, the former can become a mindless pretext for the latter. In other words, what we're going to see is that because this is the way the world's going, therefore it is inevitable. And there's an equivocation going on. What do you mean by it? What is it that is so inevitable when we, I don't know, hook up the world to the internet, for example? Okay? So in the one hand, this is a normal, natural thing that brings with it many things that I think we would agree are good things. But then what is the person, the philosopher, the reformer, the statesman? What is this person saying is so inevitable? What does he want me to buy into? Okay? So historic globalization first. First of all, let's define our terms. Globalization occurs anytime the world gets smaller. The Tower of Babel was a case in point. The Pax Romana in the Roman Empire was another. Yet it is technological advance more than military aspirations which have tended to connect parts of the world previously unconnected. One author on a primer on globalization suggests that we not define globalization as the conditions of the shrinking world. In other words, take a snapshot, see the way things are. That's not what he means by globalization. But rather we should define globalization as, quote, a set of social processes. I have a smaller streamlined definition on the top there. But he's saying it's a set of social processes that are thought to transform our present social condition. Okay, in other words, globalization is about the process of this trend, not its condition at any point. And so he lists four characteristics that mark this process, but I have here this definition that just really makes it short and sweet. Social networks and activities that transcend traditional political, cultural, economic boundaries. Okay, so you can see right away how the perfectly natural thing becomes a philosophy. These are social networks, relations, ways of relating to other people across the globe, and activities that do that, that transcend, in other words, that obliterate, that move us beyond traditional ways of relationship. What's all in that? Well, I don't know. I don't know who I'm talking to. Am I talking to Bill Gates? Am I talking to Bill Clinton? Who am I talking to when you say that these social networks that are globalized, these activities that are globalized, are going to move us into a new world beyond the old ways of what? Everything? Church? State? Natural rights? Communication? What are we talking about here? Okay? So you have to watch what's being asked and what's being tacked onto this ism. So no matter what elements you put into this definition, the creation of these networks and activities, the multiplication of them, their expansion, their acceleration, there's always a subjective element. In one way, it's like saying that this is inevitable. Namely, that globalism is not simply a worldview, but it's the most powerful epistemology in human history. And if you want some good Christian commentary on this, just read David Wells, two of his books anyway, No Place for Truth. Well, that was in 1993. Read one in 06, come on, Above All Earthly Powers. I think that's the name of it. Yeah. Where he talks about, he's a good, for a theologian, he's a good sociologist. He talks about the effects that globalization, modernization have on our attention span. Okay? So read that if you want some good theological sociology of that. But what happens in this process is that we get the idea that globalism is just, quote, the way things are. And the only way they ever should have been. It becomes not just an epistemology, it becomes an eschatology that unites modern and postmodern starting points. But globalism, in this sociological sense, is just the consolidation of the total human community. Now, I said that last week about the state, that the state has a vested interest in being that institution. So what do you think the relationship between the state, statism, and this inevitable process of globalization, what do you think the relationship between those two things are going to be? In a sense, it's a natural marriage between statism and globalism. So again, this is a perfectly natural thing, which is not me saying this is inevitable. I'm coming from an accidental perspective here. But I'm just trying to say that the things that a conspiracist would look at, in a sense, are perfectly natural things. So, in a sense, he's more right than he knows. Which is exactly why it doesn't take too much of a malevolent plot at one level. But we'll come back to that. Globalization is not exactly a new phenomenon. Clearly, the gathering of tribes in the Fertile Crescent under the political leadership of Nimrod, sometime in the early mid-third millennium BC, represented one such global integration. Alexander the Great and then the Roman Empire both attempted something similar by expanding their boundaries, annexing other cultures without inviting them to some central point. So there's different ways to do it, but we see it throughout history. But it's when we turn to the study of the modern West that things become more complex. For one thing, here's one thing that makes it complex. The colonial powers of Europe were in competition for the lands and people groups of the non-West. Christian mission and capital enterprise each rid each other's coattails, so that whenever allegiances did transcend nationalism, there was still a battle between creed and ethnic competition and mistrust on all sides. So it was always a mixed bag. I just think of the Christopher Columbus debates as one example. But this marks the first fact about modern globalization. Whatever sustained organized group effort at global hegemony that may have arisen in elite circles, it had no hope to get off the ground until the 19th and 20th centuries. And it would really be a group effort. It would have to be, much more so. I mean, when the Roman Empire and the Greeks were expanding their boundaries, they didn't have to consult with any other groups to say, hey, do you want this to be a Hellenistic culture or what? I don't know, let's just kill some Persians. They didn't have to consult other people to do that because it was just one world power expanding by military effort. All right, well, that's historic globalization. What do I mean by economic globalization? Technological advance irresistibly shrinks time and space in human experience. That is, it makes communication and economic activity faster and further reaching. Its effects are exponential. And as I've argued in a lot of other classes before, the scientific expectations of the Christian worldview in the West is exactly what fostered this cultural atmosphere in which technological advance was inevitable. There's that word again. But the acceleration of electronic and transportation inventions at the turn of the 20th century and then the computerized inventions at the turn of the 21st century have shrunk the globe to a point and at a rate that the human mind is probably not going to be able to put in its proper context. And in this sense, economics can make epistemology. Think, for example, well, I don't know, maybe you're not, some of you aren't old enough, but in 1990, there was an AT&T commercial that ran a commercial for a precursor to a sort of global debit card. And that was a big deal then, the fact that there would be debit cards and not just credit cards from a world bank, which was already, and the slogan was One World, One Card. Okay? And so, economics doesn't just run on its own when there's planners around. Let me give you one example. This will give you our first delve into the timeline there. An American-British-led economic conference in Bretton Woods, England, in 1944, reversed all of the protectionist policies, in other words, isolationism, not being open to trade in the Western nations, reversed all those protectionistic policies of the war generation. Yet it did so by creating financial and regulatory institutions with the potential to impose statist policies on the global marketplace. Time out. This is one of the first clues that the conspiracy theories are not broad enough in what they're looking at. These group of British law, by the way, one of the architects of Bretton Woods was John Maynard Keynes. And we've already seen what's wrong with Keynesian economics. If you listen to conspiracy theories, particularly people from the Alex Jones world who are libertarian, so we are told, they will focus on the, and by the way, that book that I quoted before on globalism, they'll focus on the fact that globalism is a neoliberal phenomenon. In other words, these are a bunch of capitalists exporting free markets. The main proponents of global government are capitalists. And something about that doesn't add up. If you're saying, wait a minute, impose statist policies on a global marketplace, open up markets by controlling, what? Something's wrong here. And if you're saying that, you're right. Three institutions in particular emerged. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, was organized to administer the monetary system throughout the world. The World Bank, then called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, originally meant for post-war reconstruction, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which was to craft and enforce international trade agreements. This changed into the World Trade Organization, the WTO, in 1995. So the goal of the Bretton Woods economic regime was to create an unbreakable system of controlled capitalism. By the way, again, economic regime. Is that a free market idea? Controlled capitalism. Oxymoron, right? Controlled free market. Now, it shows you that it was led by intellectuals who preferred command economics. I don't care how much money they had in their bank. Intellectuals who preferred command economics to genuine laissez-faire markets. Yet they knew enough to know that the market system really was superior in its own right. And so it seemed that what these English elites were organizing was not much different in principle than the government of China has pulled off in the most recent few decades. They're using capitalist principles and ports to make the money, but they're still commanding it from Beijing or from this group. So the Bretton Woods regime allowed for local policing of borders and currency and business so as to retain the public sense of national sovereignty. As economies began to collapse under four decades of Keynesian economic incompetence, the Nixon administration led the globalist charge to retool, beginning in 1971, by abandoning the U.S. gold standard that the whole system was predicated upon. Globalists saw the economic conditions of the 1970s as merely the birth pangs of the New World Order. While the elections of Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Ronald Reagan in the United States constituted an electoral reaction to Keynes and the Bretton Woods system, it was short-lived because the conservative movement in the English-speaking world was not large enough, old enough, or philosophically sophisticated enough to design a full cultural front as the communists had done. The economic expansion begun in the 1980s, and the collapse of the Iron Curtain was quickly reinterpreted and re-assimilated into the globalist state revolution and their narrative. One result of the mixed conclusion at the turn of the millennium is that we do indeed have a controlled capitalism of international trade. And who's going to get blamed for that when it doesn't work? Capitalism is going to get blamed for that. Freedom. The result is that the same sort of free economy in America predominates in the world. Between 1947 and 1990, the total value in world trade expanded from $57 billion to $6 trillion. And yet we hear the complaint that the profits are not benefiting nations equally. That's what's wrong with it. So if you go to your local Starbucks, you'll be inundated with impulse purchase products labeled fair trade, which comes to mean the exact opposite as free trade. At present, we have neither, which only serves to further discredit genuine free markets. Transnational corporations are made the enemy in this. They're made the equivalent in public consciousness. By the way, they are enemies in certain ways, but not for the things they're often blamed for. They're made the equivalent in the public's consciousness as former satellite communist regimes. One author says these transnational corporations, quote, rival nation states in their economic power. These corporations control much of the world's investment capital, technology, and access to international markets, end quote. The heck's wrong with a corporation having access to international markets? But they see that as an instance of force and fraud. Never seems to occur to these mixed minds that the whole thing was intended to be a mixed economic system to begin with. A mixed economic system in a different historic context, a post-war context, which is always a recipe for justifying your own existence when historic contexts change. The IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO were set up with the stated goals of rebuilding war-torn Europe and containing communism. With both those goals supposedly accomplished, the goal was said to shift to expanding markets after the fall of communism. But isn't this problematic? How will government organizations produce markets by lending money to nations that can't pay it back, preventing competition against transnational corporations, and in general doing everything they can to discredit the market system? The discerning eye will see that this will have the very opposite effect and foster the environment for universal socialism. Between the 1970s and 1990s, the Bretton Woods regime had initiated what they called structural adjustment programs, enabling poor countries to repay their debts by changing the way they do business on the inside. How's this going to be enforced? A government has to do it. A government which transcends those national boundaries. By the way, third world countries, as ravished as they are not exactly excited about having an American or British internationalism imposed on them. And rightly so. But what's the popular complaint against this? It's not socialism. It's not the erasing of national boundaries. It's that it's called the Washington Consensus, and therefore a new backdoor form of American colonialism. The trouble with this conclusion is that the U.S. is also getting into debt, and so the fact that Washington is the latest staging ground for Bretton Woods misses the point that all such debt is being cultivated in the first place for a global government to economically destabilize all sovereign nations. The point of this plan looks economically liberal, because when it began by calling for deregulation and a broader base tax system. But it exists under the Keynesian assumption of the government upholding capitalism and keeping it afloat. But here's the value of studying all this. The value of studying this economically first, and politically, in other words, scientifically, is that it shows us a side of the process that does not require a totally cohesive human planning. Bretton Woods was a group effort of modernist intellectuals. But the reality is that much of what they saw as good was already underway via technological advance and subsequent inventions. In other words, everything that's good about economic globalization would be good without them and would be better without them, with genuine free markets. So that's one thing. But the reason why this study is so valuable to an objective political science is that it re-legitimizes the debate over whether and to what extent global government measures are helpful or harmful. It removes a portion of it from the boogeyman realm of conspiracy theory and reminds us that this is a reality and that we are responsible. Last part on this sociological view of globalization, that's political. So I looked at this historically, looked at this economically, now politically. Can we make an argument that international government is simply scientifically bad? So forget about conspiracies. I mean, my goodness, if you speak against the UN, Does that mean you're a black helicopter person? Or might it be that you just have some understanding of the Western tradition that believes that if everybody owns something, nobody really owns that thing? In other words, everything we've talked about in the first 11 weeks of this class, now just apply that to the global stage. One principle held in Western history by everybody from Aristotle to Montesquieu is that the government that governs least governs best. This didn't simply refer to the size of the state's bureaucracy, but to its per capita constituency. So in other words, we know in everyday lives that when everyone owns something, nobody really owns that thing. And therefore, no one takes the initiative or the responsibility in its maintenance. And if governments need anything, it is the maintenance or the watchful eye of the people that want to remain free from it. As the state expands its power, as it's its nature, and as the local becomes more remote, the ownership in the franchise is diminished, and the state officials become more unaccountable. Thus, there is a kind of tyranny of the critical mass. So if you agree with everything from the first 11 weeks of this class, or even a large portion of it, you should know that the expanding or the centralization of power beyond even the centralization of a nation with 300 million some odd citizens, then for those same reasons, you should realize that scientifically, further centralization will lead to the exacerbation of tyranny. So how much more would all this be the case beyond the current boundaries of nations? The fear of a one-world government is not simply about conspiracy theories. It is scientifically a bad idea, and at the same time, an inevitable tendency of an ever-shrinking and ever-secularized world. So that's an object of political science. If people are more willing to descend to the level of ignorance that a tyrant needs, and if there's more of them to be found, particularly outside of the Western tradition, there where they can be more easily manipulated, from 300 million to going on 7 billion people, well, then the temptation and the tendency is going to be overwhelming to a universal socialistic state. But as it so happens, it also happens to be the stated goal of Western intellectuals for over a century now, which, as we said, has to be admitted into the record of objective political science. If the most prominent Western intellectuals in the modern world have for the past two centuries been saying, at the end of their philosophy, no matter what philosophy it is, that the end game is global government, you have to admit that into the record of an objective political science. The earliest period of the modern world saw nationalism held in check by the designs of imperial families and their time-honored strategy of maximizing power over territorial boundaries by marriage. That's how they kept other powers in check. They married somebody's sister. And they would promise not to go to war, they would have a pact, etc., etc. The Peace of Westphalia in 1648 sliced up a part of that, or that's after the 30 Years' War, so the Catholics and Protestants were going at it and so on. But that sliced up part of that order by international law. Political right now belonged to the nations themselves before they belonged to the imperial family. So at this point in history, something of political liberty was happening, sort of against the will of these imperial families. At this point, by the time you get to 1648, there's no political power higher than the nation states. Now, not everybody lived in concert with that, but that's where these treaties, the direction they were going. Now, however that may have been refined by the advance of political liberalism, more modern theory retained the supremacy of the nation over the international for the very same reason that the individual is supreme over the nation. So I have here this circle, that the direction, the inevitable tendency at this point was going in the opposite direction that it's going now. Because of these treaties, what was happening is that the individual was actually, and in theory, the individual was deriving his rights from God. You had the Christian tradition, but very much against the will of these international families, these royal families, the nation was actually becoming more important than the international. And that tended to assume the same Christian tradition that the individual is, lowercase s, sovereign over the state. Okay, so the winds or the flow of Christian political thought and the historical happenings of these treaties were all coming together to place the individual over the nation and the nation over the international. And that was good for individual freedom. Woodrow Wilson's doctrine of internationalism, by the time you get to the 20th century, still assumed this nationalist principle in his internationalism. So by the time you get all the way to the 20th century, this is still the Western assumption for the majority of people, even if they can't articulate it. The League of Nations was formed in 1919. We're going to come back to all this. I'm sort of skipping ahead just to give you a little preview of where we're at, big picture. The League of Nations was formed in 1919 and the United Nations in 1945 as the final expression of this new flow of thought toward the international. Yet the formation was orchestrated by those in the Roosevelt administration who were taking orders directly from Moscow, as the 1991 opening of the Soviet vaults finally proved. But here's the kicker, and here's why it matters. Maybe this will be the last point in the first session. Article 25 of the UN Charter, this is right from the beginning in 1945, states that all members of the Security Council, there's five members, there wasn't then, that's another story altogether, but U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and eventually China, all members of the Security Council must comply to all security resolutions, even though two of those five member nations have been communist and were communist when they were brought in and were brought in because they were communist and their stated goal was to eliminate the existence of the United States. So help me understand this for a second. The United States is going to spearhead and create an organization that this article, 25, says that all members of the Security Council supersedes the law of their nations and will invite two of those five nations to be nations that have specifically said that they intend to wipe us off the map. Alrighty. This is obviously an act of treason. Historically, any nation would have seen that as an act of treason by these officials in the U.S. government. And yet these officials have counted on the lack of intelligence among the American population, and this gamble has paid off. So, last point. Here's what the conspiracy theorists often don't see. Let's combine what we've seen between economic and political globalization. If you're a Keynesian, maybe refer back to our week on economics, but that's a worldview. You know, the government pumps up the demand side, and that's what stabilizes business cycles, so on and so forth. Point being, if there's any capitalism worth having, it's controlled capitalism. So if you're a Keynesian, that's going to affect how you hear the other side. It's also going to affect how you see other people doing things. If you're a Keynesian and you see economic organization as a centralized intellectual contrivance, then you're naturally going to see the argument of capitalistic globalists as an economic argument rather than a political argument. In other words, you're going to say they want to expand markets and corporations, not government control. So one author comments, quote, most of these globalists, he has in mind neocons, people like that, the people of Bretton Woods and so on. Most of them consider political globalization a mere secondary phenomenon driven by more fundamental economic and technological forces. These commentators look forward to a new phase in world history in which the main role of government will be to serve as a superconductor for global capitalism. Now, first of all, if you even use the word superconductor at all, you're not a true capitalist. As the author continues, as if he alone sees the contradiction, quote, the problem with this claim is that the globalist message of liberalizing and integrating markets is only realizable through the political project of engineering free markets. Thus, globalists must be prepared to utilize the powers of government to weaken and eliminate those social policies and institutions that curtail the market. Since only strong governments are up to this ambitious task of transforming existing social arrangements, the successful liberalization of markets depends upon intervention and interference by centralized state power, end quote. Now, no doubt there's a lot of true believers among the universal marketeers, but those people believe that status, much like Marx believed about the state, is just going to wither away. There's a lot of people that really, really believe. They're not part of this elite group, but they're just They're economists, they're free market advocates, and they really believe that if you just drop blue jeans or MTV or whatever else, that's what it was 15 years ago, into some third world village, boom, a democracy will flower. Well, that's pretty naive. If you do that in third world countries and groups that have not been exposed to the 2,000 years of ideas that built that up, what's a bunch of villagers? This is not an ethnocentric statement. This would be us too. Anybody that is not exposed to the ideas that made this happen, which by the way is going to includes us too, because we've been gutted of those ideas. But man, if you don't have any culture whatsoever, and a bunch of UNICEF planes drop a bunch of food and blue jeans and, I don't know, CDs and other stuff, the nobody in their right mind as a villager is going to say, "Huh, I wonder what 2,000 years of ideas built all this. Let's go read Cicero and Montesquieu and form reading clubs." And they're not going to do that. They're going to say, "Hey, where'd this come from? That white bird in the sky, well, throw a rock at it, get more to come down. Beat it like a piñata." That's not an ethnocentric statement. It's just a reality of that's human nature. Okay? Thinking is harder. Beating the piñata, called the state, easier. At any rate, markets without the rule of law will guarantee slave markets. Capitalism that is controlled will guarantee that the richest benefit at the expense of the benefits of true competition for every economic strata. Democracy without objective truth will be the legitimacy of the global dictator. Freedom as a concept will become the culprit. At any rate, where all of this ends up is that the majority of works on the subject of globalism frame it as a neoliberal phenomenon, with the advocates of the free market as its driving enthusiasts. So that is just absolutely ignorant. That is as ignorant in these social commentators as it is of the conspiracy theorists, but they're ultimately saying the same thing. I lied, there's one more part. Philosophical globalism. Here's what's really driving it intellectually, because that's where you have to start. Philosophical globalism. Before we tap Vladimir Lenin, let's go to John Lennon. Because I think, you remember this song, Imagine? Of course you remember that song. Have you ever read the words of that song? Yeah, it's pretty scary. Let me read you the words, I won't sing it. Every single line. You don't even have to play this backwards. It's forward, it's socialism. All right. Imagine there's no heaven. And it's not just socialism. Listen to the words very carefully. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. So he starts in philosophy, top of the stairs. Imagine there's no countries. It's not hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Isn't that so wonderful? You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, as the world will be as one, and the world will be as one. So that's a crucial ending phrase there. Second stanza, there's more. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Alrighty then. So what's at stake in globalism? It's not hard to imagine at all. A world without borders to a secularist, and especially to a Marxist, but really anybody who's a collectivist. Anybody who's a totalitarian, which is not a James Bond villain. It's somebody with a philosophy who really believes. I remember in the 1990s, I don't know what they call these things. They used to, like in the 40s, they would do these radio dramas where it'd just be the person's voice and whatever, The Shadow and all these different old shows. Well, in the 1990s, apparently they still did this for some reason, but it was William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. But they weren't doing Star Trek. They were doing some other, one of them was William Shatner played an alien from another planet or something, and Leonard Nimoy was just a representative of the Earth, and he was explaining to him, and William Shatner was like, "You don't have any centralized power? Well, then who organizes economic activity? How do you keep people from fighting each other?" And I was like, "Oh, no. I'm going to kill these people right now." So why? Why is this important in this philosophy? The Humanist Manifesto, Part 2, in 1973, states this. "We deplore the division of humankind on nationalistic grounds. We have reached the turning point of human history. By the way, the turning point of human history is always when you and your smart friends are there to turn it. But anyway, we have reached the turning point of human history where the best option is to transcend the limits of national sovereignty and to move toward the building of a world community. A system of world law and world order based upon transnational federal government, end quote. So the left sees some problems with this, but the only problems they see are irreversible capitalistic triumph, a depersonalizing consumerism, and the cultural imperialism it'll take to pull it off. For example, the Muslim world's probably not going to vote for this, right? Right? They're not going to. And the reality is most third world countries don't anyway. But for most true believers, these are risks worth taking, or small prices to pay for the ultimate dream of a singular, peaceful world. Just to give you one crazy thing that goes with it, first conspiracy, then I'll go to Ted Turner. Because he's not as crazy as the... Well, no. Anyway, you ever hear of the Georgia... Not Seer Stones, Georgia... Stones. It's kind of like Stonehenge for America. In the 1970s, this rich guy, he tried to remain anonymous, and he built these stones, five of them, pointing, if you look from the sun, down, they represent the five different religions or whatever, I guess. One's in Hebrew, one's in Arabic, one's in Cyrillic, maybe Russian, some Cyrillic, and then so I said Hebrew already, doesn't matter, five different languages, representing on these five stones, basically like these kind of new Ten Commandments, and all of them say the same thing, the Ten Commandments of globalism. And people look at this and they say, well, none of these really seem very controversial. Very Shirley MacLaine-ish, but not really controversial. But one of them, I forget which one it was, calls for population sustainability, namely, more than 2/3 for sure of the world's population reduced. Ted Turner was on Charlie Rose's show one night, and he was asked about the New World Order and stuff like that. And one of the things Ted Turner said was most important was to get the world population down to 2 billion. Now, I'm no mathematician, but now he said that could be done by convincing people to only have one, maybe two children in some specific special cases. I wonder who makes it special, by the way. Maybe Ted Turner. But at any rate, they believe this. They really, really believe this. So the fact that true Marxists and the capitalists that live up to the Marxist caricatures have wound up in the same bed is as true as it is perverse. But how exactly this proves, and this is what you'll hear from conspiracy theorists, they'll treat the communists and communism as a boogeyman, similar to like the war on drugs. But we'll get back to that. So let me just end it there, and then we'll get into the really hairy stuff when we get back.